You start now?
Yes, please.
Okay. Hello, students. Yesterday we were talking about the power of using neuropsychological measures like EEG in pinpointing more precisely the cognitive deficits. And yesterday we were talking about cerebral palsy. I'm sorry. Today, I would like to change the subject a little bit. What can we do with those experimental tools with respect to treatment efficiency? What I try to say is that, of course, in order to find out whether a treatment is of any help, it is wise to use questionnaires before the treatment start, halfway, then sometimes later. And that gives space to patients to tell the researcher how they feel now after the treatment, during the treatment, etc., etc. But when you talk about children, then, there are all kinds of problems. Children, especially when they are quite young, then questionnaires can hardly be used. So then you have to rely on opinions of caretakers, opinions of teachers. Of course, there are practically no other options. You have behavior observations, but of the children themselves. But you can imagine that parents and also teachers could be biased in a certain direction in rating the child's behavior. And also parents themselves, when you compare father and mothers, then it might be that both sources of information might differ. That is to say, for instance, in the opinion of the mothers, there are beneficial effects of the treatment, but the father doesn't see it, or vice versa. It could also happen that both sources of information may agree, but then it might be different from what the teachers have to say. This type of research, by the way, is of course taking place. And again, much of that research shows that opinions may disagree. So who to believe? Which source is the most reliable? Now, yeah. That is a matter of discussion, and again, a lot of research is taking place. So today we are going to talk about the role of, for instance, using those theoretical tests in measuring the efficacy of intervention. And I have chosen, also for other reasons, to choose in favor of phenylketonuria, and the abbreviation is PKU, and it is an inherited error of metabolism. In the next slides, I will try to explain what that means, metabolism. But At this stage, you have to realize that it is an inherent, inborn error. And it is an autosomal recessive disorder, which means the following, that you need two carriers, the father and the mother. And They both are carriers of the genes which are responsible for developing PKU. Well, what could happen if that the son is healthy, no PKU, then we have a daughter and she could become a carrier. It also could mean that when this couple is delivering a son, that the son is a carrier. And here we have a girl. It could also have been a boy, of course. And she will develop PKU. So this means autosomal recessive disorders that you need to carriers, and then one out of four of the offspring will develop the disorder. If it would have been different, that it is not recessive but dominant, then one carrier is enough to produce the disorder. But recessive means exactly this. Okay, we start with food. And I am aware, by the way, that the first few slides are only two slides, and they are overlapping with the course I have just given. But I'm our students who have not followed the biological course, so I have to introduce it a little bit. So the point is that when we are eating, the food most of the time contains a lot of proteins. And after the food intake, the proteins are broken down into amino acids. So it starts with proteins, and then we have amino acids. And now it comes. When we are talking about people who are developing PKU by means of the genetic factor I have just discussed, those people are lacking an enzyme in the liver. And that enzyme in the liver is of essence because the amino acid might be broken down into phenylalanine, and then it continues the metabolism, so changing substances from one characteristic into the other. So once again, that enzyme which is missing in people who are developing PKU means that the breakdown of phenylalanine into dopamine is missing. So what happens in PKU? Because of the enzyme is lacking, a buildup of phenylalanine up to a toxic level. Yeah? So this is another representation. We talk about metabolism, in this case in PKU. The plan is that we have phenylalanine broken down because of an enzyme which is sheltered in the liver. And in people who don't have PKU, the metabolism goes first to tyrosine, and tyrosine is a precursor of dopamine. So this, the metabolism from phenylalanine to tyrosine to dopamine, is taking place in normal individuals, but in people who are developing PKU, this change this metabolism remains absent. And as a result, it means an overproduction, which is taking place of phenylalanine in the blood, and it will be transported to the brain, and a lack of dopamine. So PKU means two things: too much of phenylalanine and too little of dopamine. And I have now explained this to you. Dopamine, here we have the circuits. And here we have the brains. And here we have the frontal cortex. And we have discussed this already earlier, that the frontal part is very much of importance when it comes to the regulation of all kinds of cognitive abilities, among others, impulsivity. It tries to control the impulsive. It is of importance with respect to planning. It has to do with motivation. It has to do with mood. So the frontal cortex, has a very important place in the field of neuropsychology, developmental neuropsychology. And you see all kinds of innovations . But there are more. We see also innovations to the striatum. And here, the substantia nigra, there are the production centers of the dopamine. There are at least 4 or 5 dopamine circuits. Here you have the chemical formula. And we have at least 3 subgroups with different functions when we talk about dopamine and a lack of dopamine. One group is related to movements. So for sure, when we were talking about cerebral palsy, there must be also a so-called dopamine hypothesis, lack of dopamine. But also, when it concerns Parkinson's disease, which is, of course, a movement disorder, it is also linked with a shortage of dopamine. And the later phases of dementia are connected with dopamine. Then we have the mesolimbic system. So that is, let's say, what is here going on. Mesolimbic system. And that has an important function in emotional behavior. And then we have the mesocortical projections. And that goes to the prefrontal cortex. And now, I repeat myself when I read aloud. This area is involved with various cognitive functions, memory, planning, abstract thinking. It has to do with emotional aspects in relation to stress, etc., etc. So now you see that dopamine is really a key in developmental neuropsychology or in neuropsychology as such. There are, of course, also other neurotransmitters, acetylcholine, serotonin, etc., etc. And they are, of course, all of importance, otherwise they wouldn't exist. But dopamine as such is Quite an important one. How does it go when we have here the blood? With respect, how does it go with respect to that huge amount of phenylalanine? Here we have the blood. And here we have the brain. And this is then the barrier, which is in a sense protecting the brain against all kinds of toxins. But when it comes to phenylalanine, these are, let's say here, depicted, and these are all kinds of other substances. It goes from the blood to the brain, and here you see that in the transportation, it could be considered like a train or a bus, that there is so much phenylalanine that they are taking place in this bus, in this train, and it goes to the brain, and here you get then an overproduction of phenylalanine, as I have explained to you earlier. Here we have some ranges. So the normal range for phenylalanine, the normal range for tyrosine, and the precursor of dopamine, and it is expressed in millimole, and then also a ratio is of importance between these two substances, and it all concerns healthy individuals. So we are talking here about the norm. And here we are talking about people with PKU. And then you can see that there are, of course, many different types of PKU, although it is a very rare disorder, luckily. You see that PKU patients, they may have values of 12,000. So look, that is much more, as in comparison to the norm, the control group. And then we have mild PKU. And these cases, they have values between 600 and 1200. Let's first have a look what happens when those patients are untreated. Here you see an example of a child who has received no treatment, and we call it untreated PKU. And here we see all kinds of lists of problems related in people who are developing PKU. Severe mental retardation, so it means an IQ at least below the 80. The brain serve volume might be too small. It's connected with epilepsy, all kinds of behavior problems. You may think for instance, ADHD, behavior problems, growth problems, skin problems, and because to the fact that they have too much phenylalanine in their system, they may have a different odor. They are, you have to say it not so nicely, they may smell, they may stink of urine. And that is because they have too much acid-like things in their body. And this was in the 30s and earlier. The only sign on the basis of doctors could make some sort of diagnosis. And here you can read the name of the pioneer. He is from Norway, and he was the first who tried to investigate the ins and outs of phenylketonurie. And you see the child is really, in all respects, when you look at the body, just as quite handicapped. Nowadays, this is very much of importance to say, you don't see this anymore in the Western world. When children are born, just after they are delivered, it's a matter of days sometimes, their blood is checked in a laboratory, so all the neonates get some sort of a check whether they are developing PKU or other metabolic disturbances like congenital hypothyroidism. Well, we have discussed this in our former course. So we don't see this anymore. And here we have old data. So before the worldwide, or let's say in Europe and America, etc., in the Western world, you don't see these figures anymore. But in the time that children were not detected by means of the blood investigation, you can find this. So this is an IQ that goes from 100 to 30, 20, 10. So here we have the IQ on the y-axis. And on here we have age in years. 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. And now you must imagine that in the time, again, that there were not nationwide detection systems available to detect those children. And suppose that doctors were in the 30s and earlier, they detected by chance children who were untreated, let's say, before they were 1 year of age, then you see already a drop. And here the treatment starts. We will talk about the treatment in a minute. What kind of treatment? You see that there is an increase up to 104. So when children were found and they were younger than 1 year and the treatment started, then it is possible to increase their IQ level to 104. But here we have children who were detected later on in the development. And you see the drop in IQ from 93 to 56. So these are different children. And here the treatment starts. And then it is possible to increase the IQ up to, well, what does it say here? 68. It doesn't matter so much because I can't read this so well. But anyhow, you see, it is still possible to produce beneficial effects in the IQ. When children are, again, older, then there is already an IQ drop to 44. And of course, when the treatment starts, then you see that the IQ goes to 55. And when children are, let's say, about 3 years of old, of age, and then found by accident, for one reason or the other, parents went with their child to a physician, then there is already a drop in IQ on the average of 32. And then you can start the intervention, and then it goes only to 42. So here, these are all data, but it shows that untreated, and at a certain moment you start the treatment, it has a tremendous effect on the IQ level. You see what a tremendous drop. And the longer you wait, the less effective becomes the treatment, because this is the upper limit, 42, which is far from the normal range. So treated, untreated, we hardly have those concepts anymore, but it shows you how devastating the PKU is when it is untreated for a while. The treatment itself, it has to do with the diet. Of course, additionals are part of the treatment, but in principle, we could say that the treatment consists out of a strict diet. And the idea is that children are not eating food containing a lot of phenylalanine. Yeah? So the strict treatment is plotted here. So returning to this issue, you understand now that we start with proteins, it goes to amino acids, and here is the problem. So the food intake, that is, let's say, the key in the treatment. And we have here then the protein substitute, which is part of the diet. So what kind of cognitive research using experimental tools is taking place? Now, part of the research is, of course, concerned to the question, to answering the question, which cognitive functions are impaired in early and continuously treated PKU? So now for the first time you see here early, and it must be continued, the treatment. Then a second question is, what is the relation between the cognitive impairments in relation to concurrent and historical phenylalanine? So now returning again to this picture, here we're discussing the normal range of phenylalanine and tyrosine in the blood in normal people. And here we have the people with PKU. And we had two types, the classical type and mild types. So now the question is it possible to get those children in this range? Because this is, let's say, normal. Well, that is not an easy job. Some children are really reacting fine on the diet, and others are very difficult to they react, maybe they overreact. It can also happen that the balance is not okay. That means that there is a huge variability in the amount of phenylalanine in their system. And what I have just presented to you is the concurrent levels of phenylalanine and the historical levels of phenylalanine. Let I start with the historical levels of phenylalanine. Suppose that a child is 8 years of age and he has been visited the doctor already many times. They are monitored many times on a yearly basis. And then the idea is, how are the values? And you can imagine that when you investigate all those dots, or all those scores, then it could be that some children are quite stable. It could be too high, but at least it is stable. It could also be a little bit lower, a little bit better in that sense, and stable, but it could also vary a lot. And very little is known so far about what is more harming to the brain. Is it huge variability or small variability? And maybe it is that the more variable the levels are, the more harmful it is for, let's say, the developing brain. That is one issue. The concurrent levels of phenylalanine, it is, let's say, measured 45 minutes or an hour before the neuropsychological testing is taking place. So there is a blood sample taken. It goes to the laboratory, and days later, the researcher gets information about the phenylalanine level 1 hour before the actual testing is taking place. So once again, on the one hand, the research is the theoretical research is devoted to the question, what does it mean, PKU? What systems, cognitive systems, are compromised? And to what extent in people with PKU? And the other question is, can we use those theoretical measures in order to lower, to measure to what extent there is an effect and what is the best level? That is what people in the field of PKU, the doctors, wants to know. They need psychologists, they need people who are experts in brain behavior research from a functional, from a performance perspective, and then research findings have to find out what is the best target, intervention target. Okay, what can we expect in the children? So when it comes to what are the consequences of PKU, so we are not now talking about treatment, but what can we expect? Well, I have already explained to you that the frontal part of the brain is very vulnerable for a lack of dopamine, and the frontal part, it is... These are the functions of the frontal part: inhibitory control, working memory, flexibility, cognitive flexibility, so that you can jump from one task towards another. Strategic thinking, organization, and planning. So what you see here is that these are frontal lobe functions. PKU means a lack of dopamine, especially in the frontal lobes. At least that is a very important hypothesis. So you might expect that all those functions, important functions in life, are compromised. Here are the parts of the brain which are involved in all of these functions. You can have a look at it when you have some time here. Task, working memory. Now that is has the color green, so these are the green spots, and you can see that in the brain all these spots can be investigated in PKU to see what is the consequence. What you can also see is that when we talk about PKU and look at all those skills which could be compromised in PKU, that when we talk about ADHD, well, they might have a lack of inhibitory control. They might have working memory problems. What about autism? Well, they are not so flexible. What about planning and organization, strategic thinking? So the point is that people with PKU, that they represent problems you can also find in ADHD and, for instance, autism. So social behavior, well, autism is defined in terms of weak social behavior. We return to that issue later on during the course. When it comes to emotions, aggression, well, it also could be part of autism or ADHD. And what about planning and inhibition? It's all put under the umbrella of executive functioning. Well, you may expect to find it in ADHD. So it could be that PKU could be seen maybe as a biochemical model of ADHD and autism. And here you see the preciseness. We talk about classical PKU when there is more than 1200 millimole of phenylalanine available. We talk about mild PKU when there is 600 to 1200. That is, in a sense, quite precise. If we have to talk about, for instance, the diagnosis of ADHD, then we know that the start of the diagnosis was that parents were asked to fill in a questionnaire. We talk about the 50s of the last century. And also some interviews took place based on those questionnaires or vice versa. But anyhow, the parents were determining whether the child could have the diagnosis of ADHD. Yeah, So put into other words, the person who was making the diagnosis was listening to what parents, caretakers, had to say. And later on, the diagnosis was based on parents and now also on teachers. Only when parents and teachers were agreeing, then the child received the diagnosis of ADHD. In practice, those sources of information had very low correlations, maybe of 0.50. So it means that with respect to some children, the teacher was claiming the child has an attentional problem. And then the parents would say yes, but it also could be a no, or vice versa. Nowadays, we have a diagnosis of ADHD, which is based on parents, on teachers, and also that the people who are involved in making the diagnosis can see with their own eyes their behavioral observation whether the child has ADHD or not. But you can always say, well, at the matter of fact, the diagnosis is based on opinions. And here we have the diagnosis, which can be, at least for us as behavioral experts, quite sharp. So that is also a reason why PKU could be served as a contrast. What is going on in these children, and how is it comparable with children with ADHD and or children with autism? Okay. Here we have all kinds of examples, but I think it is time for a break of a little bit more than 5 minutes, and then we continue, okay? Okay, you had your small break. Let's continue. And here you see some findings when it comes to all kinds of executive function deficits. And the researchers here were using those classical paper and pencil tests. I have discussed that concept with you during the first lecture. And now you can see here that here we talk about the range. So probably we talk here about the amount of errors. And then you can see that the controls, well, some children have more problems than others with this executive functioning deficits. So planning and response inhibition. And here we have children as a contrast group with hydrocephalus. And here the PKU, and you see that on the basis of those paper and pencil tests, it shows that a huge proportion of children, in spite of the treatment, they are all early and continuously treated, that a huge proportion of these children, 21%, have problems with these types of functioning. And here we talk about attention problems in early and continuously treated individuals with PKU. And here we have two clinical populations, people with PKU and people with diabetes. And then you can see that the people with PKU outperform this group when it comes to attentional problems. And again, what is used here are the clinical attention tests, which are normed. The problem is that they are not so specific in what exactly is disturbed in these children. We have discussed that, but anyhow, it gives information that although treated, many children have problems with attention problems. And here we talk about school problems in individuals with PKU. And then again, you see that especially the people with PKU, they show much more school problems and, so problems with arithmetic, problems with verbal tasks, maybe also handwriting in comparison to the norm group. And here we talk about social behavior. Much more problems than in the control group. And it also, here we see. So there are all kinds of problems, cognitive problems detected in early and continuously treated people with PKU. And here, these findings show psychiatric outcomes, in this case, in adults with PKU. And here you see depression, phobias, anxiety disorders, problems concerning hypochondria. People are very worried anxiety at work, and in all these domains, you see a overrepresentation of people with PKU. So, psychiatric problems, cognitive problems, and here we have a conclusion of a review article of Christ et al. They did it in 2010, and they said, yeah, well, there was a problem with working memory, and especially in older PKU patients. And when it comes to inhibition, so the ability of impulse control is also compromised. And when it comes to shifting attention, then findings are not evident. So in one of those key reviews, this is the one of Christ et al. 2010, it seems that impulse control is compromised in the group, and also working memory. Now we are arrived at the point, what we did in the Netherlands, and we did all kinds of cognitive studies, reaction time studies, and here we have 64 patients with classical PKU. They were compared with the control group. And the question was, which level, what could be the best target level? We have explained that to you. And it seems that 240 to 360 millimole, that is the best target we have at the moment. So children are put on a diet, and the target on the basis of cognitive studies shows that this is the best target clinicians could achieve at the moment. And this is the result of cognitive studies from a more theoretical perspective, and that was one of the ideas of this lecture, how powerful the experimental neuropsychology is. What do we have to offer with respect to those who are working with those patients with PKU? And when you are trying to find a job in the future, you could be involved in these types of studies, finding good experiments and try to find out whether this indeed is the best target. It might depend on gender, it might depend on age, and there are maybe much more factors involved than we have investigated. And that is, of course, science in action, to continue where other people have stopped. This is the work of one of my PhD students who received her promotion in the city of Groningen. Here, another result, that the people who had a value of less than 240, they performed much better than the people who had higher levels. This is just one of the results, and you can read it more carefully when you become interested in this field. You will also find, of course, other studies, hopefully, and you could write a very interesting paper. Anyhow, the conclusion so far is that when we compare PKU patients with controls, then this is the best target. When it is higher, those phenylalanine levels, then people are performing worse on the tests. And especially when the patients have phenylalanine levels above 360. Now, this is some sort of a repetition in the sense that dopamine is critically involved in executive function, emotion, and social behavior. And again, you see those dopamine innervations, and especially the frontal lobe is innervated by dopamine, and a lack of dopamine may cause all kinds of problems, and we have already discussed this. And what links PQU with ADHD at the biochemical level? Well, here again, you see that CLIFT. So here we have a cell. We have discussed this already earlier a little bit. Here is the pulse coming. Here are those cells filled with dopamine. And because of the dopamine, the pulse can jump from one cell to another one. So this is compromised in PKU. There is a lack. We have discussed this. And it also might be the case in ADHD. So this is the biochemical link. Here we have a comparison, a direct comparison, between people with ADHD and controls and patients with PKU. And here you can read a fast task. So it means that the events of the stimuli which were presented on the screen were projected very fast on the screen. So let's say every 1 or 2 seconds, decisions had to be made. We have talked about this issue. And here we have the reaction times. And this is the slow condition. So this is a more boring test. It's the same inhibition task. And here we have the findings. And let's start with the controls. So the performance of the controls is as such that here they perform quite well. And in the slow task, because of the fact that also, normal individuals get bored. They are slow. And here we have the people with ADHD. Their performance is very sensitive to this manipulation. So fast, it could be motivated. Slow could mean that it is a boring task, and especially the people with PKU, the people with ADHD, the performance is very much influenced by this manipulation. And here you see that the performance of the people with PKU is about the same as the controls, with respect to speed of performance. Here we have the same finding that especially in people with PKU, also the variability of performance is very much influenced by a fast presentation rate of stimuli and a slow presentation rate of stimuli. And that would be the subject of our next meeting, or maybe we can make a start of it. It depends a little bit on the time. And here again, you see that the performance of the people with PKU is about the same as the controls, as far as the variability and the speed of processing is involved. But when it comes to error making. And you see that the people with PKU are making a lot of errors in the fast task and in the slow task. So it means that on the one hand, they are as fast as control, when we talk about speed of cognitive performance, but probably at the expense of making a lot of errors. And we don't find it back in the people with ADHD. How to explain this? Well, that is that Pugh curve, and those who have followed my biological course, they know this curve, hopefully, when we're talking about aggression. The Pugh curve means you have the stimulus presentation. Here we have the buildup of evidence. And here the brain knows how to react, because here all the evidence is available. So this is would be the best moment to react. You know what you see and you react. But when you are reacting here, so the stimulus evaluation is taking place, it's, let's say, not even halfway, and you are already reacting, then we talk about impulsivity. Well, that is exactly what is taking place in the PKU group. Fast as the control group, but at the expense of a lot of errors. So maybe they were acting too fast according to their information processing system. They need more time. Yeah. And that is exactly what we found in the University of Ghent. I was there for years, a visiting professor. Here we have the event-related potentials during the fast condition between people with PKU and ADHD, and you see no difference. And here in the slow condition, you see that the P300, which could be here, is delayed in the people with PKU. So they need more time in order to give a correct response. And in the slow condition, the people with ADHD, you see that their amplitude of the P300 is much less pronounced than in the controls, which could be lack of motivation. So PKU and ADHD, they have a lot in common when we talk about investigating the groups using the classical tests, a lot of school failures, a lot of attention problems, a lot of executive problems, etc., etc. But when you are starting to do this type of research, then you see that although they have a lot in common, the groups also may differ. And that is, people with PKU, they are impulsive. And the people with ADHD, yeah, that is a different issue. Once again, here we have the reaction times, and they become slower when the task becomes boring. Because when the task is, let's say, motivating, a fast event rate, so it also comes close to, all kinds of computer games, then you see that the people with ADHD are acting the same as the norm group. But as soon as the task becomes boring, they start do make errors and become slower. So we see that they also are different. Now, this is the end of the PKU. Now I have to try to show you, so I go out of this. I hope that I can make this. First, I go to my documents. Can you see this now? Hello? Hello?
Yes, can you we see the same presentation.
Oh, you don't because I started a new file.
So I think that you have to reshare the screen, share another time the screen.
Yeah, but
how? I am sure.
Let's see what happens when I documents. No. No. Och. I'm absolutely not handy in these things. You noticed that already. And maybe I have to go away from here. Do you now see it?
Yes, now we can see the folder. I think that
this is the new file.
Okay.
Is that correct? Diagnosis of behavioral symptoms?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No, I can see the folder, but I don't know if it's the PowerPoint is open. The presentation.
Yeah, but can you read now attention deficit hyperactivity disorder?
No. I can see the folder with all the presentation, but not the presentation open.
Yeah. Okay, maybe I stop here. Well, this is nice, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that maybe if you stop the sharing and then create another.
Yeah.
Maybe. Okay.
I do my best. And otherwise, we meet again next week. Because it was still.
Sorry.
Still had 50 minutes to go, so it is not. Jonge. I can't make it. JP. Yeah, you can't do it. Now, I wish Elisha was here now.
No, I saw the see the present the folder.
Yeah. I can't make it. Okay, you have free. Let's do next week again. Is that okay?
Okay.
Yeah, it was just 15 minutes, so it is not so much of a... Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Have a nice day. Bye. Yeah.
Bye-bye. Jezus, nog aan toe zeg. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.